session, the Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Catherine G. Leonard, and Lisa M. Ginoza presiding. Please be seated. Case number CAAP 11-000-0999, Davis v. Vansel. James Bickerton for appellant, cross appellee, and James Shin for appellee, cross appellant. Argument on the merits.
Good afternoon, counsel. Before we get started, I just want to make sure we got the timing issue right. So as I understand it, Mr. Bickerton, you got 10 minutes for your rebuttal, and that you, Mr. Shin, are saving 4 minutes on your cross appeal for rebuttal only on the attorney's fees issue.
That's correct.
All right. Are both counsel ready? Mr. Bickerton?
May it please the court, good afternoon, Chief Judge Nakamura, Judge Leonard, Judge Ginoza. This is a case arising out of probate. Probate is an unusual area because all of us believe that we can protect those that we love following here. If we stop and think, what's going to happen when we're gone? And the power to almost everyone in this room is a lawyer, so we have that extra ability to protect our loved ones. But when we're gone, who or what will? The only thing that really stands between them and being destitute is the legal system. So in this case, that legal system failed in that fundamental task of protecting a widow. You start out, I think, with the indisputable fact that for purposes of this case, she was the widow. It's completely undisputed. It's alleged in the complaint. The summary judgment was not based on any contention that she was not the widow. It was based on the contention that no duty was owed because she was not a client. So we start from that situation. Because this was summary judgment, it was decided before Ralston versus Yim.
Excuse me, Mr. Bickerton.
Yes.
Sorry. My understanding, the part of the fraud count, count two of the complaint, is that one of the false representations was that the widow would not need to submit further proof of marriage. How can that be fraud? How can that be a misrepresentation if it's uncontested? I thought it was contested. I thought that was sort of a core dispute.
Well, two actual points in response to that. First of all, if you examine the record closely, Mr. Vansel stopped actually contesting that she was the spouse or that there was a spouse, and that's important. Was there a spouse? He was not contesting that there was a spouse for much of the case. He was actually contesting her identity. She spelled her name, Sangin, two different ways on different documents because of the Thai translation. She even put a declaration in the record explaining that. He nevertheless said, well, I'm not sure it's the same person. Prove that you are that person. But the question of whether they were married, he initially raised, but it was settled quite early. And you can just tell that by his conduct and by his letters and by the things that he was arguing over. But my point that I made a little earlier was not that it wasn't to some extent disputed in the underlying case. Initially it was. In this case, the claim against Attorney Vansel and his law firm, it was undisputed for purposes of this appeal because we alleged it under Rule 12b-6 and every other motion, every other rule applicable. The allegations in our complaint are taken as true, unless on summary judgment someone comes in and shows that we can't prove it. And that was not part of the motion.
So what you're saying is that at the moment they filed the complaint or and going forward to the present, it's undisputed that your client was Mr. Davis, the decedent's wife.
That's correct.
But I think the question really is going back to the time period of the probate matter and the
yes.
time period before. Clearly, at some point early on, it was clearly in dispute. At some point, there's correspondence as to, you know, whether that's still in dispute. And I think the question is, in the probate case, they denied her petition, right, to recognize her as a wife ultimately.
No, actually, I don't believe that it was denied on the basis that she wasn't the wife. It's not clear to me exactly why it was denied, but it could well be that she did not oppose Nicole becoming the personal representative at that
right.
point. They're two competing people. Nicole's representation to her is that we'll proceed in a cooperative manner.
Right.
She lives in Thailand. She is not sophisticated about America, so she allowed Nicole to go ahead. And so in that sense, yeah, there's no ruling by the court or understanding by the court that she wasn't the wife. And this is a very telling point. If you look at the original, very key document is the original petition by Mr. Vansel, petition for approval of final accounts, not the original one, but the one that took away her rights at the very end of the case, the one that we're appealing from the order on. In that, he recites a chronology of what has happened, and he says, and this is a docket 24, page 1090, paragraph 10, he says, on August 2, Mr. Matsukawa did this. Then he jumps. The next thing he says, on March 14, 2005, so he goes to the following year, he skipped a very critical event. On September 10, 2004, Mr. Matsukawa filed the certified copy of the Thai marriage certificate in the record. That's all he had to do. There's been no contention by the Vansel parties that there was something wrong with the authentication, it didn't have the consular seal, or it wasn't a real Thai government document.
But apparently the probate court ultimately rejected that, right? Otherwise, why wouldn't the court have found that she was a heir, a beneficiary of the estate?
Well, it was on file, and then Mr. Vansel brought his own papers, both parties brought papers, in which Mr. Vansel basically said, look, there's still doubt about that filing. But my point earlier was that he skips right over that. Here he is. There is in the record proof. Okay, there is a Thai government document. And he then tells the court, the same document where he skips over that, he tells the court, Sanjan Davis has refused to authenticate her identity. It should be dismissed for failure to prove she is the surviving spouse. She failed. He goes on and on. She's never presented any evidence, but the evidence was in the record.
Okay, so there's no misrepresentation that she wouldn't need to prove marriage.
There are several times that misrepresentation was made. I'm simply going what's on the record in front of the judge in the probate court, but in the correspondence, there are several instances where Mr. Vansel told, and we list them all, but one of the most telling ones was in May, so here we go around the clock, in September they filed the marriage certificate. The beef between September of 04 and May of 05 over the marriage certificate was no longer that it was the most technical of things.
Let me ask maybe a generic question. I mean, lawyers in cases always accuse each other of misrepresenting things. That's litigation. I mean, it's not infrequent in cases in which you'll tell the judge, hey, that guy, he just misrepresented the record or he misrepresented what he told me. And I'll give you an example. Sometimes prior to trial, you might stipulate, okay, I'll stipulate that to a particular fact or you don't need to call that witness. But then right before trial, I change my mind. You know, I can't stipulate anymore. You're going to have to call that witness. Are you saying that if we, in those situations, those are all cases in which if the opposing party loses a lawsuit, they can sue the lawyer for fraud?
No, absolutely not.
What's different about the situation in this case?
Okay.
People are accusing each other, lawyers, of misrepresentation all the time. What's different about this case?
It's a probate case. That's what's different, and that's why I started there. What happens in a probate case is that the lawyer is, this is not like Jim Bickerton and James Shin fighting the case out, fully arm's length and in attack mode and on guard with each other. This is the lawyer for the estate. The widow, if she's the widow, is in fact the prime beneficiary of that estate.
But when is she a widow? Isn't she only the widow when the court says she's the widow?
No, she was the widow when she got married.
But isn't the lawyer for the estate more like the, I mean, he's not representing her. She has her right to her own counsel. Doesn't he need to be sort of neutral? I mean, he shouldn't be giving legal advice. He shouldn't be promising one thing or another. She shouldn't be relying on it. I mean, doesn't he have almost a duty to question her status?
He does, and then when he says, I've questioned you three times. You've submitted three sets of documents, and I now find them satisfactory. You have proved you are the spouse. That is the May 26th letter. That is before any order of mediation. He says, I accept that. Let us now move on to the other remaining issues.
Well, wasn't it the obligation of her counsel to then say, okay, let's file something with the court in which you acknowledge to the probate court that you've accepted my client as an official or undisputed heir of the estate or spouse in the estate?
Perhaps it was, but...
Is that any different from my situation? Hey, don't worry, we'll stipulate, everything's fine. I changed my mind, I can't stipulate anymore?
Does the failure of Ms. First of all, I would suggest, and I mean, this is not really in the record, but I talked to probate attorneys, and you can talk to a probate judge. Do wives have to come down in every case and present their marriage certificate and file something saying they were married in order to be the widow? That isn't the way the system works. This is constant communication going on between the representative of the estate and the representatives of heirs. The representative of the estate says, okay, you're an heir. I accept that. Now let's proceed. When that heir runs out of money, can that lawyer then turn around and tell the court, they never showed me anything? That's what he did. He told the judge, they've never showed me any proof of anything, when he told her to her directly to her lawyer in writing, I accept your proof. So I'm not saying that Mr. Matsukawa couldn't have been a little sharper. In fact, if this court makes a rule that you have to be that much on your guard, that when the representative of the estate tells you, I accept that you're the heir, you better go down and get that recorded, or else he can flip around and tell the judge you're not. I think that would be a much more dangerous rule than the one I'm proposing, which is that if you make that clear, it's like accepting someone into a tent. When you haven't been in the tent, you can be my adversary. Once I invite you into the tent, I say, you're in here now. You're on board. It's a different ballgame. That's when duties arise. That's when you have to take care of the widow. That's what we're saying. It's a very narrow question that we're presenting. We're not saying you should always rely on your adversaries. There's a lot of case law that says you should not, although...
Mr. Bickerton, let me stop you there. Before you get on to the duty part of it, okay, so with regard to the fraud, the misrepresentation allegation, if we accept your position, okay, that representations were made that were fraudulent, part of the analysis is the reliance part, and... the attorney's argument is, well, she filed an objection. And so I think I understand your position, but I'd like to make sure I'm clear on what your specific reliance argument is. And is that an issue of fact, or is that just a matter of, in your view, a matter of law in this case?
Well, I think that this court or the Supreme Court has held that for fraud, reliance must be reasonable, although there was a concurring and dissenting opinion by Judge Acoba in that case, and the name of the case is escaping me at the moment, in which he said, no, it doesn't have to be reasonable reliance, it just has to be good faith reliance, honest reliance, because why should we let negligence trump fraud?
So in this case, with your client having, through her stepbrother, if I understand, having filed an objection in the probate court to that last bit of the probate proceedings, what is the reliance specifically?
Well, I think the reliance is that, first of all, I think in cases of constructive fraud, which is what we're talking about as well in these counts, the traditional reliance is not required. I'll tell you how it injured her, and you can cast it as reliance. It's certainly reasonable. A person in her position who's being denied the widow's exemption, she's being denied any money out of the estate. Mr. Vansell knows that she's in Thailand, that she's living in a third world country, that she's probably unemployed, she doesn't have a lot of resources. If he starves her of that exemption and she doesn't get any money during the pendency of the probate, she's not going to be able to fight. She used up her limited resources on Mr. Matsukawa and then couldn't pay Mr. Ross. He now knows she's without counsel. He sends a motion to her in Thailand, a pro se person who has no lawyer here, it's 30 days notice, the minimum that the probate court rules require. She is able somehow to get a piece of paper filed in the court the day before the hearing, but as often happens in our circuit court, something that comes in on the day before is not seen by the judge. we're certainly entitled to the inference under summary judgment standards from the record that the judge never saw.
We don't know one way or the other because the court doesn't address it in its order.
But on this record, I'm entitled to that inference. Since the court didn't address it, a reasonable inference is that it was unaware of it. That's a reasonable inference that you are required to take on summary judgment.
So absent the alleged misrepresentation, what would your client have done differently in terms of presenting to the court?
If he filed an objection, what
else would she have done than what she did?
If he behaved as a proper lawyer is supposed to behave, he would have gone to the court and said, "We're ready for distribution. I've accepted that she's the widow, and here's how it should be distributed according to the statute."
Mr. Bickerton, doesn't that go to some of your other counts? I think Judge Ginoza was asking about reliance specifically on the fraud count. I mean, and you've kind of jumped to damages and what's really a different, you know, part of your case here. But on the fraud is what we're trying to understand. It appears that she wasn't reliable, whether her response was effective or ineffective, it appears that she was not relying on the representation. She didn't have to do it because she did object. It might have caused her damages. That might be part of the duty.
I can address that, I think, very clearly. First of all, if Mr. Vansell had been, we don't know when he was telling the truth. Was he telling the truth when he said, "I accept her proof," or was he telling the truth and he says, "I don't accept her"? But if she believes that he's accepted her proof and she does nothing for many months, that's her reliance. She doesn't do anything because if she knew he was objecting, she'd be getting some way getting that paper into court. She'd say, "There's a lawyer in Hawaii who doesn't believe I'm married. We're going to give the court what it needs." When he, as the representative of the estate, has said, "I accept that you are the widow," she doesn't have to do anything. She's just kicking back in Thailand waiting for the distribution.
So her allegation is, had you not made the misrepresentation, I could have established to the court's satisfaction that I, in fact, was married to the decedent.
In a timely way, too. But by lulling me and then waiting until the last possible minute when you know I, and he waits until she's run out of attorneys and run out of money. And then, yes, that's why she relied. At the point when she had counsel, she still had counsel, she could have directed them to do something, but he waits until she's exhausted all her funds. And he exhausted her funds by raising a lot of very manini silly things. If you look at he's arguing over the date, there's a clerical error in a date. You can't even go behind a formal government document like that, but he made a big deal out of it, made Mr. Matsukawa go and dig up what the explanation was. And that costs money. Every time Mr. Matsukawa has to pick up the phone and call Thailand, there's Thai attorneys too. So, yeah, that's what happened. She ran out of money, but she was okay. She relied on his representation, so it was okay to run out of money and not dig up anymore. My light is on. If I may reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if the court has no other questions of me, I would like to reserve them.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shin?
May it please the court, Chief Judge Nakamura, Judge Leonard, Judge Ginoza. I represent the appellees, cross appellants in this matter, Gary Vansell, Mark Van Pernis, and Van Pernis Vansell. And I'll collectively refer to them as the law firm in this oral argument. Now, my intention this afternoon is to address the two motions for summary judgment which were granted by Judge Ibarra in the underlying case, and also address the issue of the attorney's fees on the cross appeal. Now, this case arises out of the lawsuit filed by Sanguin against my client, the law firm, for alleged breaches of duty, fiduciary duty, fraud, as well as legal malpractice. And this all arises out of my client's representation of the estate in the probate matter of Richard K. Davis. Now, the counsel for Sanguin raised the issue that we had somehow admitted that Sanguin was the widow in this particular matter. Now, the complaint filed in this case, the first amended complaint, was answered to by my clients. And with regards to the paragraphs regarding her status as the widow or as being married to Richard Davis, the answer was, we're without knowledge as to whether that's true or not, so we therefore deny the same. Now, if you look at all the pleadings filed in this matter, Sanguine Davis is noted as the purported wife, the alleged wife, or the claimed wife. There's been no admission of that fact before the court today in the record.
Mr. Shin, yes. Your motion granted by the circuit court was a summary judgment motion.
Yes, it was.
There are two, and certainly so with regards to the first one, which dealt with the fraud claims and the duty claims, essentially, the non-assigned claims is how I would phrase it. The plaintiff submitted declarations by counsel that previously represented her in the probate matter. And, I mean, there's no opposition, or there's nothing that was filed by the attorneys, the firm, that challenges the representation. So the representations clearly were made. The letters speak for themselves, right? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, here, why isn't there a genuine issue of material fact specifically to the fraud claim?
Okay. Well, let me go back on that, because when those materials were presented... At the summary judgment, first summary judgment motion, we had filed a reply. And in that reply, if you notice, we said, you know what, plaintiffs have not, or Sanguine has not contradicted our four facts that we're relying on in the first motion for summary judgment. And we took the position that any of this other information they've inserted is totally irrelevant.
So your point is it's immaterial.
Yes.
And because the facts, I think, that you asserted was that your clients represented the estate and not either Nicole or Sanguine. That's the factual basis upon which you...
That's correct. And we also said everything else was irrelevant. This would have included all of the discussions regarding the settlement and the representations made during settlement negotiations as well as mediation.
Mr. Shin, I'd like to direct you to the same issue that we were asking Mr. Bickerton about, which is really narrowing it in for a minute anyway onto the fraud claim. And Mr. Bickerton says that the reliance, the representation, the misrepresentation is that you don't have to prove your widow and that she shouldn't, and that's maybe the duty issue, but on the fraud issues, that representations were clearly made. You don't have to, good enough for me, you don't have to prove you're a widow, and the reliance is she did nothing for many months, and that is enough to at least raise a genuine issue of material fact, not necessarily as a matter of law, but raise an issue of material fact on the fraud claim.
Yes, and that my response to that would be that you have to take the context of how that statement was made. And I raised this in the oral argument at the first motion for summary judgment, where I told the judge, was it reasonable for her to rely on a statement which was made during settlement negotiations or during mediation negotiations? And that's important because...
Right, but reasonableness, as I understand the current state of law, is generally a question of fact. And since we're reviewing summary judgment, that's the issue for us.
Yes, and my other argument on that is, and it goes to just the public policy of why, for instance, the mediation rules are there, the probate mediation rules are there, Rule 408 is in place, and that's because the courts want to encourage discussions about settlement, and they want to encourage compromise. And in this particular case, what was occurring is the parties were ordered to mediate by Judge Nakamura.
But you have a representation that precedes the mediation order, correct? We've accepted your status as the widow of the decedent.
Yeah,
that's before the court orders mediation.
This is my understanding of the chronology of the events. What occurred was the Sanguine had filed a petition for statutory allowances, and the law firm had filed on behalf of Nicole Davis objections on the basis that she still has not provided enough proof that she was actually married to Richard Davis. And the court, at the hearing on that petition, looked at it and said, you know what, I still don't have enough proof to verify that Sanguine was married to Richard Davis. And there was some other issues regarding place of domicile. But the court at that hearing basically said to the parties, you know what, I'm going to order this into mediation. So at that point, and I think it was in April perhaps of 2015, and I'm searching for the date right now, Your Honor, but right around that time is when the date the court indicated, you know what, resolve this. And that's precisely what the parties did. So as far as the timing issue on when this misrepresentation was made or this alleged misrepresentation, our position is that it would have been because of what the court had ordered at that hearing on the petition.
Well, Mr. Shen, we can go back certainly and look at the record. What I understand the record to be is that there was a May 26, 2005 letter by Mr. Vansel, in which he said, we no longer require any further proof of the marriage of the decedent to your client, Sanguine Davis. And then 4 days later, there was a hearing with the court. So let's assume, just for the sake of argument, we can all go back and clarify that and make sure. But let's assume that was the case, that there was this statement in a letter prior to any order of mediation. What then? Well, isn't that a representation that that Sanguine reasonably could have relied upon?
Well, she could have, I guess, relied upon it for that 7 days, I guess, until the June 2nd hearing or court ruling on the petition, where the court ordered it into mediation and where the court said at the hearing, basically, you know, I need final certification to determine whether or not you've submitted the proper documentation to prove you were married.
Okay, so you don't have a dispute that someone in Mr. Bickerton's client's position can assert a claim of fraud against opposing counsel or the estate's counsel based upon a intentional misrepresentation.
And, Your Honor, what I would like to point out, and I started to go into this about mediation and settlement negotiations.
Right, but assuming the hypothetical that Judge Ginoza gave you, that there was, not related to mediation, there was a misrepresentation made by the estate's lawyer to the widow.
Well, you know, I still wouldn't say so because it's in the course of litigation. And, you know, I practice all the time. And, Your Honor, you brought this up about, you know, stipulations and withdrawing stipulations and things like that. And I don't think, at least, there's not a public policy reason for holding attorneys to certain representations they make during the course of litigation. And
but your argument on summary judgment was simply that reliance was improper. There was no reasonable reliance. You didn't argue that there's no cause of action in this context for fraud.
Yeah, that issue did not come up. However, then we went to the detrimental reliance as well. And they could not prove the detrimental reliance, as the court noted, because she did file her objection before the court ruled on it. And it is Sanguine's position that somehow it's our burden to show that the court actually reviewed the document. However, there is a presumption under Rule 304 of the Hawaii Rules of Evidence, which states that basically an official duty regularly performed is assumed to have happened. And this is Rule 304C2.
Well, what about the timing issue, though? Because Mr. Bickerton is arguing that because of the timing of the fact that the estate was not accepting the widow as the widow, she didn't have enough, and she was relying up until that point upon the representations of the estate counsel that no problem, you're accepted as the widow, that they didn't have time to get together the information that would have convinced the court that, in fact, she was a surviving spouse.
And
why isn't that at least an issue of fact as to detrimental reliance?
Because my response is that what they claimed they were going to submit to the court, they did with their objections. All of that was submitted with the objections, and I believe that there's statements to that effect in our case that basically, you know, this is what we were going to, well, this is what was submitted to Mr. Vansel, and this is what was submitted with the objections. So basically, Your Honor, they were able to get whatever documentation they claimed they needed to verify that she was married to Richard Davis the day before the hearing, and that was in the record.
But is the claim that if the law firm didn't tell her this was good enough, they would have gotten something better?
I don't know if that's actually ever been alleged in that way, Your Honor. At least my understanding is that what they're saying is that the court did not even review what they had submitted.
What was missing? What could she have gotten in your client's view? I mean, your client, obviously, the law firm went to probate court and said, not good enough, right? What was needed?
Well, I mean, what was submitted to the court in those objections, that was the first time that that document had been filed, that they were relying on. I mean, some of the other documentation had been filed, but the I believe it was...
But that's what was filed.
Yes.
What wasn't filed that caused your client to say, well, that's not good enough?
Oh, I don't know, because we didn't even know it had been filed, apparently. At that time, it was filed the day before the hearing with the court.
Right. But if you subsequently receive it and it, to your satisfaction, establishes that the widow is a surviving spouse, don't you have an obligation to go to the court and say, "Hey, Judge, now we've gotten sufficient information to establish that Mr. Bickerton's client was an heir of the estate"?
And, Your Honor, I've reviewed the petition that was filed, and I think one of the other issues that was raised was the declaration which had been previously submitted by Sanguin was not proper because it had not been drafted in the tie and then interpreted by the interpreter. I believe that was one of the arguments that was raised, in which case I do not believe that they submitted a document which would follow those wishes at that time. Now, going to this, the representations which was made. Now, and I started talking about compromise and settlements. And basically, when there's a settlement or settlement negotiations, each side gives up something. And I've been involved in negotiations where I don't admit a liability for the purposes of either the mediation or the settlement. And, you know, I'll either admit liability or I'll say, hey, you know what, you've shown me these medical billing statements or whatever, you know, I'll assume that they're true.
Well, was it clear that the status was being given up only for the purpose of settlement negotiations? If I'm giving up liability in a settlement discussion, and I don't do that anymore, obviously, but I'm for sure going to say, for the purpose of this settlement discussion only, I'm giving up liability, reserving all rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, mm-hmm. That's what, as Mr. Bickerton said, lawyers do.
Yes.
You know, they have all those qualifiers.
Yeah, and some lawyers do, and, you know, a lot of it, lawyers do, but some do not.
But if you're arguing context, isn't that itself an issue of fact? That's a fact finder to determine that these representations were made in this particular context, and therefore the reliance was unreasonable. I mean, aren't those factual issues to place the context in which the representations were being made?
Well, yeah, but I think it goes to a public policy issue of whether representations made during settlement negotiations or mediation should be actionable.
Yeah, but I think, Mr. Shin, the question really is, in a summary judgment motion, we're supposed to assume facts in a light most favorable to the non-moving party. I think you're assuming them in the opposite, which is that you're assuming that they were in the context of mediation. So I think that's really the question. Isn't that a genuine issue of material fact that needs to be fleshed out here if we're all arguing about or concerned about whether it was in the context of mediation or not? So isn't that certain the summary judgment standards apply in that respect?
Well, I can see that, Your Honor, but again, it's still my position that because of the policy reasons behind settlement negotiations and representations made during settlement negotiations, it's my position that those comments should just be disregarded as far as being actionable fraud.
Okay, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Is it is it the obligation of the parties in this case to object to the admissibility of evidence in a summary judgment proceeding, or they're waived? In other words, Mr. I think if I read the briefs correctly, the other argument that Mr. Bickerton makes is that there was no objection to those letters being admitted below. And
in my response to that was, and I stated that previously, in the reply memorandum, a specific objection was made basically saying all of this other information or letters or evidence or whatever, anything else is irrelevant. And that was made in the record in the reply brief itself.
Yeah, irrelevant is one thing, but admissible or inadmissible because they were made in the context of mediation. Was that argument made below?
Well, what was pointed out was these comments were made during settlement negotiations. But the specific, if you were to say, was there a specific objection which said, under Rule 408, my position is that these should be stricken because they're inadmissible. That specific objection was not made.
Because under Rule 56, we look at admissible evidence, but there also is case law that says if a party doesn't object to evidence, then
yes,
they have waived that, right?
And I realize that, Your Honor. And again, that's the position that we objected on all of the other evidence on the basis that it was irrelevant.
So your position is it would be in the reply brief to the summary judgment motion?
Yeah, well, yeah, with that statement that everything else was irrelevant. And as we know, Rule 408 is a relevancy objection. Okay, now moving on to the duty issue. Now the Blair versus Ng case is instructive with regards to the duty issue. And in Blair versus Ng, what we had was a situation where there was an attorney who basically represented a testator who was estate planning and, among other things, drafted a trust. And one of the trust beneficiaries brought a lawsuit against the attorney for the testator, alleging breaches of fiduciary duty. Now, the court, in determining whether or not there was a duty to a non-client, basically looked at six factors, and these six factors were taken from the Lucas case. And the court determined, after looking at these six factors, determined that these beneficiaries were intended because this trust was meant to benefit those beneficiaries. And in addition, the court looked at the issue that the beneficiaries had no other recourse against the attorney. There was no one else to sue except for the attorney in that situation. Now, in this particular case, what we have is an attorney representing the estate. And in our particular case, Nicole did have recourse, and that was to bring a suit against the personal administrator. And that's precisely what she did in this case. This case that we're here for today was originally filed as a lawsuit against the personal administrator. The attorneys were not named in the original lawsuit. And we all know today that the Cyan settled with the personal administrator, reached a settlement agreement, and as part of that settlement agreement, received a condo as well as an assignment of claims from Nicole to Cyan. And so in this particular case, Cyan had recourse and she did pursue that avenue. Furthermore, the law firm was representing the estate in this particular case. At no particular point in time did Cyan ever seek legal services from the law firm. She had her own attorney, and it was undisputed that she never even had contact, direct contact, with the law firm. Under these circumstances, and under the analysis in Blair versus Ng, it's clear that the factors show that no duty should extend to the beneficiaries of a probate estate. And this view is consistent with the mainland case law, which I've cited as well, the Grimes case, as well as the Trask case, I believe.
Let me take you on a little bit of a different angle here, which is you referenced the settlement between Sanguine and Nicole.
Yes.
And that settlement was, well, there was an order of good faith settlement that was vacated in a prior appeal.
That's correct.
What is your position with regards to the assigned claims, which I understand from the briefs are articulated as count 1 and count 8?
Yes.
What is your position on the summary judgment ruling on those claims at this point?
Yes. As of this point, it's still our position that those claims cannot be assigned, that Nicole, any claims that Nicole may have cannot be assigned to the plaintiffs, because legal malpractice is a personal claim. And if Nicole were to pursue that claim on her own, which she hasn't, by the way, there's been no claim filed by Nicole against anyone in this case. To the extent that she tries to do that, in reality, that claim is actually an assigned claim, because under the terms of the settlement agreement, Cyan retains 85% recovery on any of those claims. So in essence, Cyan controls that claim. She gets the bulk of the recovery.
Part of the challenge is it's not in the record in this appeal, in turn, because the settlement issues were remanded back to the circuit court. But does the settlement exist still?
Well, you know, I have got to look back at the terms of the settlement agreement. I don't know if it was actually conditioned on the finding of good faith settlement, because you can still have a settlement agreement without a good faith settlement.
You don't have the protections of the good faith.
Yes, you just won't have the protections of the statute itself. So arguably, you know, they could still, that agreement could still be in place, but I don't know. But, you know, if we were to say and speculate that, you know, what if it was conditioned on the finding of good faith settlement, and that there was no, we know that there was no finding of good faith settlement in this particular case, and if Nicole still had those claims, she just hasn't asserted them.
So your position at this point in this appeal is you're assuming those claims continue to be assigned? Is that a fair statement or not?
No, well, because my argument is that they've been dismissed by the court pursuant to the second motion for summary judgment.
No, I know, but the only reason they allegedly existed was because they were assigned, and then the court got to the summary judgment rulings in light of the allegations that they were assigned. Well, I'm taking us further back, which is, are they even assigned in your view at this point?
And, you know, that I don't know. You'd probably have to talk to Cyan and Nicole to see what type of agreement they have as to those assigned claims, or what was identified as the assigned claims. Now,
what's your subset argument?
Oh, yeah, the assumpset. And I was going to actually rest on that, on the pleadings, and have a little bit for rebuttal. But let me just finish off really quickly on the two motions for summary judgment. And, you know, bottom line is, you know, I'd like to point out that, you know, it's our position Cyan did file her petition, or did file her objections to the petition, and the probate court ruled against her. That order is still valid. Now, Cyan has filed a Rule 36B motion to set aside that order, but for some reason, and I don't know why, the hearing on that motion was taken off calendar. Now, I think the motion is actually technically still before the probate court, but they just have not pursued it. And we know that Cyan also filed a lawsuit against the personal representative. She filed her recourse in that manner, and she settled with a personal representative. We were only here because of statements made by Mr. Vansel during settlement negotiations or during the probate matter, and there is no lawful basis or any policy reason being advanced for allowing this particular case to remain. Now, going to the assumpset issues that are raised on the cross appeal, I would only like to add that Blair versus Ng 2 is instructive in that regards, even though that case involved an accountant. Basically, in time is up, Your Honor.
You're moving into your rebuttal time, so it's up to you.
Okay. I will use my rebuttal time right now, Your Honor. Okay. So going to the assumption claim. Now, in Blair versus Ng, that was a malpractice claim against an accountant. And basically, the court looked at what actually was the basis of the claim against the accountant, and it was based on the accountant's relationship with his client and that implied contract that he had with his client. All the claims flowed from that implied contract. And in this particular case, what we have is Sienz Davis claims against the law firm, which are all based on the fact that he was representing the estate in his probate proceedings. Everything, every comment, every pleading that was filed that she's relying on was filed in that context. So to the extent that the court was proper in granting these motions for summary judgment, and to the extent that we are the prevailing party, then when you look at the real issue here, the underlying representation of the estate, that is what the nature of the case is, and that lies in a sumpsit in accordance with the Blair versus Ng decision, as well as according to the Helfin decision, which I believe Blair versus Ng had cited to. And in fact, the Helfin decision, I know it's a Ninth Circuit case or USDC case, no, Ninth Circuit case, and they basically said Hawaii has not decided on this issue yet, but we feel that if Hawaii was to decide upon it, they would rule that a legal malpractice claim is a claim arising out of a sumpsit. Thank you, Your Honor.
I shall rest on my briefs on the subset matter, so if Mr. Shin has any time left, he doesn't have anything to say on that anymore. It's important, I think, to recognize that we're not simply saying that the fraud was in the statements, the lulling statements, we call them, made in 2005 and 2006, but it was also in the representation to the court. There was a fraud on the court. When someone has filed something that you don't mention to the court, when they have filed two things, because there was another filing on May 13 by Samuel Davis of 2005, you've also received repeated letters and documents from Mr. Matsukawa in the context of these discussions. For you to then tell the court, she has failed and refused to show me any proof, that's fraud, right there. Forget about any reliance by Ms. Davis. Lawyers can't do that.
But what's the, in terms of a cause of action by your client against the attorney in that situation? I mean, I can see the fraud, the representations, the reliance to her detriment. But it's a fraud on the court. Isn't that more like, is it 36B in probate court? Isn't that the rule? Isn't that the way that you address those kinds of frauds on the court?
I'm not saying that's the only way, because I think, I mean, for example, if you undid that fraud, as we filed a petition to do, it's too late when the money's gone. This reminds me that the case, I think, that's important, that's cited in a footnote in our brief, is the Coombs case, where I believe this court, in an unpublished decision, Coombs versus Case Bigelow, said, we recognize that you can be liable for aiding and abetting or aiding and assisting in a breach of fiduciary duty. That's exactly what Nicole had. Nicole had a fiduciary duty to the widow. In this case, we assume, for purposes of all of our discussion, that she was a widow. We're saying, if you rule against us in this case, you're saying, even if you're the widow, if you can't cross your T's and dot your I's a certain way, and if the defense can get away with it, you can lose your inheritance. That's basically what you would be saying. So we're saying, in this case, you accept that as true for purposes of this discussion.
I think the challenge is trying to really be clear on what cause of action you're moving under, and is it a recognized cause of action given the kind of unique situation here? I mean, we're talking fraud in one sentence, we're talking fiduciary duty in the next, so that's part of the challenge.
This court has also addressed that, and I was surprised in going back and looking through the briefs that it wasn't cited by any of the parties, but in Giuliani versus Chuck, which is a One Hawaii App case, They recognized from the restatement that the a lawyer is liable to a non-client when he intentionally interferes with their property rights. In that case, Mr. Chuck had told his client, don't pay the money that you owe over to the plaintiff or the other party. That money was owed, and he instructed his client, don't give it to them. It was a refund of a DROA deposit. And this court said that fits under the restatement, and it wasn't a question of duty. It was a deliberate act to try to deprive someone of their property. I submit, if you look at the Matsuura case, which is cited in the briefs, that is exactly what you can do. You can come in after the fact and collaterally attack something by not the judgment itself, and I'll get to that, but the conduct of this person who caused that judgment. You can. You do that all the time in legal malpractice cases. A lawyer can't come in and say, well, the judge ruled against you, so you can't sue me for malpractice. No, he ruled against me because of your mistake. So here we have a similar situation. We have the conduct of Mr. Vansel caused the judge to rule a certain way, and that is not res judicata or collateral estoppel.
I think what it brings us back, though, to the discussion that was raised by Judge Nakamura's first question early on, which is that, you know, you're talking not here about a legal malpractice claim against somebody that you've hired. You're talking about a cause of action against an adverse attorney, which, you know, we have litigation privilege in Hawaii recognized by some of our case law. Now, fraud, I think those cases recognize that fraud may be an exception to that privilege. But all these other things that you're speaking about in terms of a cause of action against the adverse attorney, that's the challenge, I think.
There are limits. The Kahala case talks about litigation privilege, and the there are exceptions to it, abuse of process, malicious prosecution, for example, and fraud is another one. What we're saying in this case is that you can sue a lawyer for deliberate actions. We're content. I mean, yes, there's negligence alleged. And this court may say you don't owe a duty of care. We think you do at least owe the same. The probate court rules talk about the lawyer for the fiduciary owes those same fiduciary duties. It says that in the commentary.
No, I'm trying to come up with a limiting principle in this case. So let me ask you this. If same fact, you claim that your client is in fact the surviving spouse, but the lawyer for the estate never represents to her lawyer that don't worry about it, we're not going to contest it. Would you be able to sue the lawyer for not recognizing her despite compelling evidence as being the surviving spouse?
I don't think so. I think that if the lawyer for the estate took a position that was in good faith, in other words, he had a legal Rule 11 basis to say she was not the spouse and took that position, it's up to the widow to take the steps to prove it. I think what changed here is when he made, as a representative of the estate, he makes that formal statement made before mediation, and again, I want to stress this, again after mediation. The letter of, I'm going to get the exact date on it, just one second, February 15, 2007. What he did was he sent to opposing counsel Ross a draft of what he was proposing to send to the mediator. And so Mr. Shin wants to say, well, that's relating to mediation, you can't talk about that. But what that was a letter that says, here's what's going to be in the mediation, and here's what isn't going to be in the mediation. The question of whether you're the spouse is not going to be in the mediation because you have proved it. So it is the exact opposite of a settlement made in aid of a statement made in aid of settlement. In fact, there's a different public policy that comes into play. We have a public policy that say we enforce compromise agreements. If you've got two or three disputed matters and you settle one of them, we have a policy saying, okay, that's stuck. And this isn't one of those where, well, let's put that on the side and see if we can resolve the others. You can't get to those other issues as to what your distributional share is until you've passed that threshold question of whether you're the spouse. That's why it had to be taken care of, and that's why it was taken care of. That February 15, 2007 communication to Mr. Ross is clear and unambiguous, and it's expressly outside of mediation.
So you think the triggering event in this case is the law firm's telling your client's lawyer, we're accepting her as the surviving spouse.
And More than that, I don't even think in every other case that would necessarily do it. In other words, you'll have these situations where lawyers say something and then change their mind and maybe there is or isn't reliance. It's because it is probate. It is because, as Mr. Shin says, he's supposed to be neutral. It is because he is the representative of the estate in a formal position telling an heir something. That combination of facts, when he makes that statement, she has now had her arms, the estate's arms embraced around her. She's taken into the family, into the tent. You're on board. At that moment, she's entitled to relax and to rely, and that's what she did. And we submit that you can't, maybe not every count will survive, but you cannot say, as Judge Ibarra said, that this person has no remedy whatsoever against the lawyer who did that. I just don't accept that. I don't think this court will either. Thank you.
All right, we'll take this case under advisement.